Blog Talk Radio.
Before supper was made, fighting for Satan in my arms. Not there. It's a thing up here.
Alright, race fans, how the hell are you? It's another episode of Race Chat Live. Glad to have y'all here on this Tuesday night. Hopefully it's nice and cozy wherever you are. You're enjoying a little bit of the warm weather. We've definitely broke away from wintertime here in the South. We just had a last little cool spell, and we'll be begging for that in about 6 months. So, glad to have y'all. Of course, we're just coming off of our trip from Talladega, and what a trip it was. It was I experienced three seasons, as always. You experience everything but winter, so you get fall, spring, and summer all mixed into one. Just to cut things short, they had predicted rain all weekend. It was going to be a washout for Saturday and Sunday, and, you know, we just said, hey, you know, it is what it is. We cleared our schedules through Monday, and, you know, we call it a Talladega miracle, man, because Saturday night the rain come through, and by 9 o'clock Sunday morning, everything was gone. There was no delay in the racetrack, and the race is getting started. As y'all seen, it was sunny and beautiful, so it was a little bit on the cool side. Very rarely do we drop down into like the 60, below 65 range, but we were definitely, especially for the April race, but we were there this time, 63 degrees, I think. But, you know, if you were not in the breeze way, if you were out in the sun, it still was definitely hot. One thing we didn't have to worry about so much was the Dega burn. And the Dega burn, anybody that's been in Talladega knows, being out in that sun all day long, most of the time you come home, you know, red. Red is one of those fireballs, hot balls, whatever the hell they're called, hot balls. I don't think that's what they're called. But anyway, I don't know where to go tonight on our yearly, daily rant. I know that I started the season against Jim France. And I don't think much has changed between what we've got going on with the charter system, the car. We have another driver that's injured, right? We have another driver hurt. Okay, Jim France, we got another driver that can't race this weekend because he broke his back in a car that's too stiff. Okay, when you go 180 miles an hour, and you build cars that go 180 miles an hour, but you stick them on a freaking road course, and they can't go no more than 110, and there's no freaking walls, okay, that's a good enough car. But these guys are putting their lives into it. Look, I've been going to Talladega a long time. I'm a humongous fan of super speedway racing. But that's uncalled for. We had a car that could not that could withstand these types. I understand Eric Amarola, you know, you want to bring that up. That was a rear-end impact that was a little bit different with the 43 car. It was also at Kansas, I believe. But there was a rear-end impact. It wasn't a head-on collision. You know, luckily, I guess if you could say luckily, it was his back and not his head. But even still, this car has been known to be too stiff. It's been known to be built like a box, and it doesn't give. Hearing Eric Jones on the radio communication should send a chill through every executive's and NASCAR's spine, and it should send a chill to the fan as well, because I don't want to give up the best racing that we have. There's a reason why Talladega has 160,000 people there every year. It's a reason why 320,000 people show up in that little bitty town, you know, between the two races. And it is what it is. Like Daytona, it is what it is. Like, that's a big race. That's people go to there. They flock to it. There's no reason why our drivers shouldn't be safe. Justin Allgaier tore the wall down. The car was bent sideways, y'all. But the driver walked away, right? We can build a car that can protect these guys. But no, Mr. Jim Frantz had to say, oh, well, I want my series to be more like the image that I've created over here, okay? I got a program this year. I never have bought the program before, but I just decided, you know, I always buy the car. And so you buy the car and the program for $25, right? The car is $15 on its own, so you're basically paying $10 for the program. Lo and behold, I opened the program up, and it's a lot of stuff about Talladega, but guess what's in the middle of it? Out of nowhere, out of place and everything. I've got pictures to prove it. Now, I can post these pictures. It's IMSA. It's an advertisement for IMSA. It's articles about IMSA. Look, I love sports car racing. It's a great series, and I enjoy the Rolex 24 Hours of Daytona. But nobody asked IMSA to be NASCAR, okay? NASCAR is NASCAR. IMSA is IMSA, right? And you know, we race the ponies, you know, the Mustangs and the Camaros. And, you know, they don't belong there. But neither one of the manufacturers put forth enough effort to build a car that could be passed off as a fast sedan, right? We're not even in the script on that. And, of course, it's not like the Ford Mustang looks like a Mustang. The Ford Mustang looks like a freaking Chevrolet Camaro with Ford emblems on it. There is no difference between the cars except for the nose. So we built a car that's not safe, right? And we killed restrictor plate, super speedway racing. We've killed short track racing. Jim Frantz, please. You can't even get the charters done. You can't even get the deal done. I'm surprised you even got the broadcasting deal done. But no, the most important deal is making sure that these guys have an investment and can get a return on it, because it's a business. And I think that's one of the hardest things for fans to understand, for racers to understand, when it comes to a track, that racing has to be a business in certain areas. If not, there will be no racing. Jim Frantz, please, just take it from an old guy who has been to your racetracks 26 times now. Step down. It's okay. Go back and enjoy your IMSA series. It's time to give up the reins, and it's also time for me to bring on my co-host, Mr. Taz Taylor. Taz Taylor, I hate to start it out again, but I also, as a fan, am devastated by the news that another driver has gotten hurt and will potentially miss races this season because of a sanctioning body that refuses to open their eyes if they created a car that is not as safe as the previous car. What are your thoughts on this, Brad Taylor, as we open up tonight's Race Chat Live? We're glad to have you. Yeah, I feel like shit, but I'm here tonight. We're going to make it happen. So let's do it, Taz. What do you think, man? Come on.
Oh, man. You know, it's a bummer that Jones, you know, had his accident. The question relies on what were the Toyotas doing at that time? Because, I mean, I want to focus on this. I'll get back to the Eric Jones deal, but what were the Toyotas doing at that time? It was just a group of by themselves. All they had to do was stay single file, not worry about passing, try catching up to the lead pack because they were on one strategy. And, nope, let's just get out of line, let's check up, let's ruin things. Like, they had one job.
No,
and
overcompensation. Overcompensation. John Hunter Andretti. I mean, John Hunter Andretti. John Hunter Nemechek. he finally had led some laps or whatever. You know, he was excited. Yeah, this is when you're trying to turn a Tier 3 team into a Tier 1 team. And so those guys are on Tier 1 status, and yet the driver is not capable of being the lead pack driver or the John Hunter doesn't have the experience, Taz. And I think that that's kind of how that wreck crew is created. You know, Toyota wanted to use all their pieces that they have. This is the first time that they went to Talladega or Daytona. With a car count better than, what, six, I guess?
You got four Gibbs. You have four Gibbs cars, two 2311 and two Legacy. So, yeah, you have eight cars in the Toyota cam, full time, anyways.
And six of them got wrecked. And one of them is going to cost the driver several races, you know.
I just want to point that out because, like, it drove me nuts. They actually had some numbers to work with. Wasn't like in past super speedway races where Toyotas had to figure out if they're going to pair with the Chevys or pair with the Fords. Do they go with a split decision? Just so they could, you know, even things out and balance it. And the one time they could all just run together, they're on the same strategy, try to outsmart the Chevys and the Fords like they have been all, well, not outsmart all the Chevys, but for the most part, outsmart the Chevys. And they just checked up, got a line, and just that's how the whole wreck happened. But
Let me give my analysis on this because you brought up something very interesting, and I don't know if I actually quite caught it there at the beginning. But you know, as I give it more thought, we had a race where these drivers were, Taz Taylor, they were half throttled the whole race, right? So then Toyota pits, right? And you've got the new guys, right? So you come in the pit row and everything works out, and then you're getting back up out on the racetrack, and you're trying to get back up to speed. Obviously, what this looked like was somebody checked up, or they weren't up to speed enough, and caused the freight train, right? And who's to say that John Hunter Nemechek was not realizing that into the race at the speed that they're already going conservative mode, right? Half throttle. Your idea is to catch the pack or to go fast as quickly as possible because there's going to be another group of cars come out. But that may not have necessarily been the strategy for everybody that was playing the game. And so I can really see John Hunter Nemechek thinking, hey, I got to go full throttle here. We got to go, right? Because this is in the midst of pit stops. So somebody that's leading the pack, they're like, oh, okay, well, wait a minute. I got to be half throttle here. I got to be half throttle, right? I got to stay to the game plan, John Hunter Nemechek. A rookie, basically a rookie. He's not really a rookie, but a rookie. You know, jumps out there and is like, hey, I got to go. I don't want to be the guy holding the pack up. I don't want to be the guy that's making us fall back. You know, without thought ourselves in the strategy of this race, and that's what's killing the race, is the fact that these guys are going at, you know, around the racetrack at 160 miles an hour, when the record around the speedway is 214 miles an hour. So, you know, there's definitely and look, you know, who's to say I'm completely wrong, Taz? You know, you maybe you've got a better idea of, you know, what could have happened there. But, you know, in my mind, I just feel like, you know, like the moment they come off pit road, they're already in strategy mode. Maybe John Hunter just wasn't used to that type of strategy. I mean, when you're always a back-of-the-pack team, you think full throttle, right? Full throttle. You can't tell me that all of them guys – there's a reason why Michael McDowell was leading the race. He was all about full throttle. But we'll get into that more because that guy, he won the 499, the Aaron 499. He just didn't win the Geico 500. he led 499 miles of it, baby. You know, but there at the end, that move, you can't guard the whole racetrack. And I think that we've seen that so many times before. That created another incident. But back to the Toyotas and that incident in that spot, as you said, Taz, these guys aren't used to being able to have a group of their own, and they did. And we've seen it. We've seen Chevys take out the Chevys. We've watched, you know, I don't know if I remember the Fords taking up the Fords, but we've seen this happen before, and that's the risk that you take when you're partnering with the manufacturer. As a matter of fact, Taz Taylor, if you can't, like, manipulate the race by team, how the hell can manufacturers come in and manipulate the race? Can you answer me that one? Because isn't that race manipulation when they all decide that they're going to come to pit road together? I mean, it just seems...
I think in this case, I don't think you can say that manufacturers are manipulating the race. I mean, in a way you can, but I don't – well, when you sit there and look at it, because it's super speedway racing, yeah, you want to be with your teammates or your alliances, but in super speedway races where you basically need drafting help, you need – obviously, the more cars you have to partner with you, the better. But, and I think that's where Ford and Chevy obviously dominate that factor, because they can, because at the end of the day, Chevy's going to sit here and say, look, all 20-something of you got, no, listen, all 20 of you in Chevy, I'm just throwing out a number at this point, all 20 of you folks have an equal shot of winning this race. It doesn't matter what team you're from, how much money you got, or what's under the hood. Ford is looking at the same way. I have 15 of you that I don't care what, where you come from, what your name is, what team you're with, what's under your hood. You 15 have the same equal shot. There, I mean, really, think about it. Super speedway racing, there is no real such thing as driver skill. Does somebody's equipment better? It's a matter of, are you the better super speedway racer? Can you strategize better? Can you work with your manufacturing partners? Because at the end of the day, if you don't have – at the end of the day, the more help you have, the better you'll be. The less help you have, the more in the back of the pack you are, and the less chance of a race-winning chance you have.
But that's where Toyota
has always been outnumbered. And as I mentioned, they've always had to partner with Chevy or Ford or even partner with both and do a – split decision because they've been outnumbered. Now they're starting to slowly grow their numbers. So now they're trying to figure out how can we strategize on our own and not rely on the Chevys, not rely on the Fords, not rely on a split decision if we need to go down that route.
Well, it definitely got Tyler Reddick the win. It put Tyler Reddick in play to race for the win. And I think that, you know, the strategy worked. It just, unfortunately, they lost half their cars because of an incident, you know. Maybe they'll get that worked on, and we'll see a little bit better strategy come Daytona. And it used to be July, but, hell, I don't even know when it is anymore. They've been screwed the schedule up so damn much because this guy named Jim France seems to be making all these calls. And how about, I don't know if you heard about it, but rest in peace scoring pylon, scoring tower, whatever the hell it's called. They just decided that they were going to take that out, right? And so instead of having the traditional looking up at the scoring tower and seeing how many laps were to go and where your drivers were outside the top 10, you know, it was ridiculous. Like, I don't know who's making these decisions, but, you know, they definitely need to reevaluate quickly. Before they run off a bunch of fans. And on top of that, Taz Taylor, they increased the ticket prices by almost 25% for the renewal rate. So, you know, hey, I understand inflation hits, but, you know, you can only squeeze so much out of a dry turnip. And some of these people are not gonna be too happy about that large increase. But we've heard that ticket prices went up at other places as well, so we were kind of wondering if it was going to happen to us. But it definitely has. But all in all, it was a great weekend. You know, a lot of racing. ARCA was a good race. No caution in the ARCA race. Was that? I mean, could that have been predicted, Taz Taylor? Considering what we've seen these ARCA drivers do at most of these super speedway tracks. Caution free.
Most of that cup race was caution free, and I was quite surprised. I think, what was it, the entire first stage was caution free? About a good chunk of stage two was caution free. I think there was like one or two cautions in stage two.
Yeah.
And then the end of the stage, I think, had one. And then, of course, the race-ending caution. I think that was pretty much it. So, I mean, it comes down to the experience. And I think it comes down to how well these drivers, how far a lot of these drivers have come. I think it also comes down to race simulation, practice.
Yeah. So... Let's see, what else we got here? Of course, a nasty spill in the Xfinity Series race, but old Jesse Love takes home the checkered flag. There's a lot of hype behind this guy, Jesse Love. I don't know if you call door bumper clear, but he's got a pretty good personality. And that's his dog. But he's got a very special personality and all. I just, you know, he's driving for Childress. So you have to kind of wonder if maybe he could, who's going to get to the Cup Series quicker, Austin Hill or Jesse Love? Does he have a position, with all the hype about Jesse Love, does he have a position to potentially race at in the Cup Series at RCR, Taz Taylor? What do you think about that,
Frank?
Oh, that's me, yeah.
In terms of Jesse Love, I think with, I don't know, I've never really knew about his personality. I didn't get to hear door bumper clear, but I think Austin Hill may be the next RCR guy, in all honesty, over Jesse Love, but I want to be proven wrong. Let's see if he is. But right now, everything lines up to Austin Hill, though.
Yeah, I guess you just followed the Cup Series, Taz Taylor, and that's, you know, that's one of the situations where, you know, we're always got our eye on the next up-and-coming talent, and Jesse Love by no means is a stranger. He may not be familiar to people who are just tuning in to the Sunday race, but Jesse Love has done an exceptional job in the ARCA series. He basically missed a chance to go into the full-time truck series program with Toyota, and then wound up over at RCR this year. And, you know, the guy's a rookie, you know, and already has two wins this year. So that's an eye raiser. Of course, you know, hey, Austin Dillon's won championships there. Ty Dillon's won championships there in the Xfinity series. So it's, you know, the Xfinity program at RCR has always been a little bit better than the Cup Series cars. But at the same time, you know, you just kind of have to wonder with that number three and Austin Dillon and, you know, all the talk about Austin Hill and will he, you know, when will he move up? It's the one of those deals where RCR, he may have lost Tyler Reddick, who is the present, right, the present guy, you know. But the future seems to be Jesse Love, and I hope that you'll take this time to kind of find out a little bit more about who could potentially be a superstar in the up-and-coming years in the sport of NASCAR. You kind of just know it when you see raw talent and you see, you know, the personality kick and all that that goes with it. I don't remember there being too many people that didn't think Jeff Gordon was going to be a superstar in the sport. There's, you know, there's certain drivers. Casey Kane, when he come along, people knew, you know, Ryan Newman, they knew, like, you know, this guy's going to be good. Like, he's fast. He gets it. And I see a lot of that characteristic in Jesse Love. Carl Edwards, probably Carl, I would probably compare right now, Taz Taylor, this is how much I believe in Jesse Love. I could compare him right now to a young Carl Edwards. That's who he reminds me of the most, a young Carl Edwards.
Can he do the backflip?
Charisma. You know, I'm not sure if we'll ever get that again. But that was something very special, you know. Carl Edwards made that special for us. And I think that there's been another driver, maybe Daniel Hemric, but he's only won one time. And so we've only seen one, count it, one backflip in Daniel Hemric's entire career. So maybe we'll get to see it again. But Carl Edwards definitely made that his signature. And, you know, look, I don't know if he can do a backflip or not, but the guy can drive the hell out of a race car. So, you know, we're kind of already, you know, I guess a third through the season. How many races have we done, Taz, now? Is this eight or nine?
We are ten races in.
Wow. Wow. So we're basically close to a third of the season is already gone. As a matter of fact, almost half of the preseason, half of the regular season, I should say. We're almost halfway through the regular season. Let me say it like that. You know, we've seen Carson Hocevar. We've talked about him. We talked about Noah Gregson. Noah Gregson, week in, week out, you've got to notice that guy, right? I mean, he's been up front, and it seems to be Stuart Haas maybe running a little bit better, but they're kind of in that Hendrick phase a few years ago where there's just so many new people that it's hard to really judge the what's going on over there. But there's definitely some growth there, and I think that Noah Gregson has done a great job this year. A lot of people wrote him off and didn't think, you know, he was capable of maybe being a Cup Series driver off of, you know, what happened last year and several things that have haunted him in his past. But all in all, I would give Noah Gregson a good grade. We saw Shane Gisbergen at Talladega.
Shane
he didn't call him any major incidents. Shane Gisbergen. No incidents, no big incidents. The guy seemed to catch on pretty quick, Taz Taylor. If you were to grade Shane Van Gisbergen at this point in time, on a scale of A to F, right, F being failure, A being excelente, where would you put Shane Van Gisbergen based off of where we are at in the season? And, you know, he's only got a handful of starts, but he seems to have been, first of all, his adaptation to the Xfinity series is beyond, like, anything I ever expected. But you know, just a couple of times in a Cup car. Now, tell me your grade. Tell me what do you think. Where's he at?
I'm going to give SVG a grade of probably a solid B.
Solid B.
Well, here's why. Yes, he had the supercars. So they're kind of similar to a NASCAR stock car. But I think his transition, you know, he kind of helped a little bit there. I think he still has plenty of room to grow. I think he's adjusted very well to the style of racing that between Australia and what we have here in the States. I think, like I said, I think he still has time to grow. Obviously, he will get more seat time because I think he still has Truck Series starts to do too, I believe. I could be wrong. And in terms of Xfinity, I'm waiting for a little bit more. I mean, he only has one top five in 9 Xfinity races. So, I don't know that far. I'm looking it up now.
Okay, go ahead. No, yeah, you go ahead. I'll look it up.
But I think as far as DNS, I don't think so. I think Kolig may have some speed in the Xfinity series. I don't think they didn't have speed, really. I do believe he has the talent. I think he'll have the road course speed for sure. Super speedway speed. He seems to be pretty good. I think the short tracks and mile and a half could be improved. So he has a lot of time to adjust. A lot of room for growth. He's adjusted pretty well so far.
Yeah, I was trying to get those stats real quick, but I hit a roadblock somewhere. All right, let's talk about the hot seat for real quick. Harrison Burton. I mean, what is going on with this guy? Does he need to go back to the minor leagues? Is he capable of winning in the Cup Series? I don't believe so, Taz Taylor. Based off of what I've seen and based off of what I've seen in the Xfinity Series, this guy drove the number 20 car and probably had the worst stats of anybody ever in the 20 car. He had a kind of a so-so rough start in the Truck Series. Of course, he started with Kyle Busch Motorsports at the time. But found himself in the Wood Brothers ride. I have just not seen the light bulb click. Taz, is it time to give up on the Harrison Burton experiment?
I definitely think so. He's nothing right now at all. He's not produced anything. I get Matt DiBenedetto had little to no sponsorship money behind him in comparison to Harrison Burton. But at least DiBenedetto was at least trying to run up front and actually and almost won a couple times. Harrison Burton hasn't even come close.
Right. I believe Jeb Burton is a hell of a lot more talented race car driver than Harrison Burton. And Jeb has had nowhere near the same opportunity that Harrison has had. It's been an experiment. I don't know where his money's been coming from to elevate him to where he is. Obviously, I just said I think Jeb Burton is a better race car driver than Harrison. He has never had the opportunity that Harrison has had. Harrison has been in top-notch equipment his entire inception into NASCAR, whether it was with Team Venturini or over at Joe Gibbs Racing, and now at Wood Brothers, which is actually Penske Racing. So, compare Ryan Blaney won in that car, Matt Matt DiAmandetto had some really good runs. We just don't see anything out of Harrison Burton. So if you were the Wood brothers or Penske, how would you handle this deal? Would you possibly send him to the minors, send him to the Xfinity Series, and maybe bring up one of the four developmental drivers, maybe Riley Herbst or maybe a Cole Custer? Like, could Cole Custer be worse than Harrison Burton? I don't think so, Taz. I think Cole Custer is very capable of winning in the NASCAR Cup Series.
He needs more development work. Maybe Xfinity, maybe trucks. I don't really know.
He is in Harrison Burton or Cole Custer?
Maybe Cole Custer could be the fit.
Okay, so you're saying Harrison Burton needs to go back to the Truck Series or the Xfinity Series. But that was my question. Do you think Cole Custer would be a good fit over at the 21 team? And would that give the 21 – of course, you want to keep it in-house. You want to bring a Ford developmental driver back up. Cole Custer's had experience in the Cup Series before. Riley Herbst, I'm just not really too fond of. I don't really think he's that great of a driver. Of course, both of these drivers are in the Stuart Haas camp. But I really can't name you any other Ford teams that are capable in the Xfinity Series. So, you know, the talent definitely has been, hard to find in the Ford Series camps. Because they went out and bought all their drivers. They went out and bought a Keselowski. They went out and bought a Logano. They went out and brought these brought the Stuart Haas teams, you know, the Kevin Harvicks and the Eric Amarola, well, at the time, Danica Patrick, and Kurt Busch is over to the fold. They didn't necessarily brew their own drivers. Those drivers that were brewed out of the Ford developmental programs were the Carl Edwards and the Greg Biffles and the it was one of the other guys, right? Matt Kenseth. You know, those guys were built Ford tough. We don't see that anymore from Ford in the developmental series. So maybe that's why they are still hanging on to Harrison Burton. But if I was Penske, I would be willing to make that move. You just don't see too many times people losing their rides mid-season in the Cup Series anymore. And that used to be something that happened a lot, you know, in the past. I mean, I can remember Derek Cope and Jeremy Mayfield being traded for each other, basically, in a Cale Yarbrough car and some other team that probably was defunct by the end of the year. But, obviously these days when you have that Cup ride, you very rarely lose your job. I think that if it's an eye-opener for Harrison to get sent back to the Xfinity Series and it's been replaced, I think that may, you know, give him a second chance, because as of right now, this guy's going to go straight out of the 21 Wood Brothers car and into a retirement home because nobody's going to want to put a kid who really has had all the ample opportunity in the world to have a strong run and a good car and hasn't been able to do that. So I would give Harrison Burton an F, Tyus Taylor. And I'm not big on giving out F's. I believe everybody should pass. I don't like to see people get fired, but it's just time to move on. It sucks for the Wood brothers, because just for them to still be a full-time team, I know it takes a lot of sacrifice. And, you know, being that most of these cars are housed at Penske, you just want to see them be able to get that 100th win, and they're not going to get that with Harrison Burton behind the wheel. What are your thoughts on that, and what's your grade scale for Harrison Burton?
I honestly believe that Harrison needs to be sent down. Only question is, who would replace him with sponsorship money? At this moment in time in the Ford camp, that would probably fit Cole Custer, but would SHR give him up? Being that, what is it, there's like family ties with Haas and Cole Custer somewhere along that line. And So I don't know if they would be willing to give him up. I'm not sure where else in the Ford camp that would be Cup ready. But in terms of grade, Harrison Burton is a big ol' F. There's no other grade about it. I don't think he succeeded to any expectations at all. He's had a couple of shining bright moments in the middle of races, but when you look at the bigger picture, he's not hit expectations.
Right. All right. Well, do you have another driver that needs to be highlighted? Pass.
I did have a couple. I was trying to remember who I had written down. Gregson, Anthony Alfredo needs the highlight.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was a great story this weekend, wasn't it?
That team only has one full-time employee. The 62 team does. And not only did they qualify for the Daytona 500 based on raw speed, but they also almost finished top five at Talladega this past weekend.
So, you know, the mirrored car has always been strong at super speedway races. And, you know, Anthony, you know, he's not necessarily been the most respected driver in the clubhouse, in the garage. You know, they call him the pasta boy. I don't know. Because it sounds like Rodney Dangerfield. He gets no respect. But he was able to put together
when you're a chicken Alfredo.
A solid finish. Right. I mean, he put together a solid finish, man. Solid finish. And, you know, he had a good weekend. He had a good run in the Xfinity Series race. I think something happened there, though, and he wasn't able to capitalize on it. But all in all, you know, Alfredo, you know, he's kind of like the Kaz Grala. You know, you know that there could be possibly potential there. And he does have Cup Series experience. So, you know, that where we say it, you know, get rid of Harrison Burton, who do we put there? You know, Anthony Alfredo could possibly be on that list, or Kaz Grala as well, because these guys do have a little bit of experience in the Cup car and with the current car. So I think that those are some things that the Wood Brothers shouldn't rule out. But back to the subject at hand.
Trying to think who else would even be good to go in that 21 car. It's just, I mean, Cole Custer is the only option. I don't even think Riley Herbst is ready.
Right.
Yeah, those are the only, like, two veteran Ford drivers in the Xfinity Series. And or unless someone makes a big switch we didn't see coming, like, shoot.
What about Ben Rhodes? Cup?
I mean, no Ben Rhodes? Be a shot in the dark, but.
Yeah. Let's jump ship real quick, because I did come across something that caught my eye, and we should have opened the show with this. We should have had one of these at the very first topics. The significance of Michael Jordan being in victory lane at Talladega Super Speedway. Michael Jordan is the greatest of all time because he capitalized on wins, right? Six championships, never lost one, right? But if you know Jordan's early career before 1989, he was a great ball player. He was a great basketball player, but he just couldn't beat the Pistons. He couldn't beat the Celtics, and that was what it took to go to you know, the next level. You had to get around these super, ultra-competitive teams. And Detroit, they were bullies. Boston was finesse. You had Larry Bird, who was the blackest white guy you'll ever meet. And I don't mean no disrespect by that. I mean, the guy, he would get mad if you put a white guy on him, right? I mean, he didn't want to be looked at as a white basketball player in the NBA. He wanted to be, you know, he wanted to be respected as the other guys. So, And Jordan had to face this fierce competition. Well, you know, when he finally did succeed, he, you know, ran into mixed emotions, right? Because, you know, right through the middle of his dynasty, he walks away and he goes and plays baseball. And what does he do at that task? What happened with his baseball career? Technically, people say he failed, okay? So then he comes back to basketball and he wins three more championships, right? And then he retires again and then comes back as the Wizards. And what happens there, Taz Taylor? He fails. He fails. Like, he didn't bring his team to the playoffs, played 82 games, and didn't bring his team to the playoffs. The Wizards never made the playoffs in, I believe, the three seasons that Jordan finished his career at. So, you know, he had a little bit of ownership with the Washington Wizards, and then that got dismantled, and he became an owner, a part owner in the Charlotte team. Well, I think that that team actually was the replacement team, and it didn't take Jordan very long, and I think he got the majority of ownership, but he never was able to succeed at it. But in the meantime, he had a motorcycle race team that blistered all the records and won all the big races, and, you know, Jordan was once again, you know, the champion. Well, then he started a Cup Series team, right? And they've had a little bit of success. I think that NASCAR is very privileged to have Michael Jordan in their sport just because of the eyes that are on Michael Jordan. For him to be in victory lane this weekend at Talladega Super Speedway, look, man, it's been all over all the talk shows that never give NASCAR a single minute of airtime. It was on ESPN. They had interviews with Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan's impact on the sport, we are not going to understand or know the true effects that he's had on the sport for several more years to come. But I think starting this week, we will start seeing the trend of the difference that Jordan has brought to the sport. There was a lot of eyes. I had a client today that doesn't ever watch NASCAR. He's a bread worker, African-American bread worker at the local bread place, Bimbo. And the first thing that he said when he seen me was, "Can you believe that Air Jordan's car won the race Sunday?" And I was like, "Yeah, like, that's amazing." Yes, I do. And I'm a fan of that, you know. And it's not just, you know, it's not just a certain race or a certain ethnicity. It's just the power that Michael Jordan carries, the presence. Like, you know, whether it's the Chinaman or a white man or a black man, or it doesn't matter. Like, you know, people love Michael Jordan. He's just that kind of an icon. So, Taz, my question is for you. What do you believe will be the biggest significance of Michael Jordan being in the sport? Is it going to create more opportunities to make money? I think, yes, it will for the owners. Will it bring in more high-profile type of people, such as, you know, maybe a Tom Brady or something like that? You tell me what you think having Michael Jordan in the sport means to the long-term development of NASCAR.
Let's see. I think you're definitely going to get a different breed of fans for this way. Like, maybe fans that are more sports interactive versus racing interactive. Like bringing in, like, say your basketball, people, like, all of a sudden now they're, like, into NASCAR, for instance, could come in. So you're probably bringing in a fan base of some kind. Obviously, when you have Michael Jordan, not only Michael Jordan himself, you're bringing a brand in, so that's more money and revenue coming into the sport. Then you also have, if you think about it, it'll bring in TV ratings.
Right. Think about how many people turned the channel over when it scrolled on the bottom of the TV screen that Michael Jordan's race team is in victory lane at Talladega Super Speedway. Just imagine how many people that were watching SportsCenter or Fox or whatever was their presence, and they flipped the channel over just to see Michael Jordan heisting Tyler Reddick's kid up in the air in victory lane. I mean, that's crazy cool.
And the other part could be sponsorship, sponsorships too, because say if Michael Jordan wants to be a sponsor besides be a sponsor for his race team, maybe there could be an Air Jordan 500 at Talladega or Air Jordan 500 at Bristol, like race sponsorship, or become like one of the co-sponsors of the NASCAR Cup Series. Like, I think right now we have like Coca-Cola, Geico, and I think there's like a couple others to throw in. I could be wrong on Geico, but you know what I mean. Like, because I mean, it used to be like, because if you remember, it used to be like you had the NASCAR Sprint Cup Series, you had the Monster Energy Cup Series, you had the Winston Cup Series. Now there is no sponsor. Well, one primary sponsor to highlight the Cup Series. It's multiple sponsors lined up. He could step into that role if he wanted to, and there is also that possibility because, hey, anything can happen. I mean, we've seen some wild things in the last couple of years in NASCAR.
Right, I agree, and you know, whether it's his brand or whether it's just his presence that brings in more revenue. Look, I am not very sure if anybody noticed that the emblem on the side of that race car resembled a Mercedes emblem, and it could have been mistaken very easily as a Mercedes emblem. And I'm talking about the Air Jordan emblem, and so you have to understand the power of the Jordan brand is so strong that Mercedes is allowing that Jumpman to basically look a lot like the Mercedes symbol, and they're not saying a damn thing about it. Now, you go out there and you try to draw up what looks to be a Mercedes symbol and see how quickly they send you a cease and desist, right? I mean, come on, man. Did anybody else see the Mercedes symbol on the side of the freaking race car, or did you know that was Air Jordan?
Let me take a quick look again.
Okay, take a quick look and close your eyes and see if you don't see the Mercedes symbol in there. Which is really crazy because if Mercedes were to ever join NASCAR, unfortunately, it probably wouldn't be with Toyota.
I could see the confusion.
With, yeah, definitely. As a matter of fact, let's just go to Twitter real quick because Twitter is always the place where you can find if people have similar ideas like you. So let's go here. Let's see.
Oh, one thing I want to pop in quick, and I just probably could have been discussed at the beginning of the show when we were talking about Eric Jones' injury. I'm going to counter you, Chris, because I don't think we can really blame the car entirely, even more for another driver getting injured, because if you look at that wreck at the end with LaJoy basically driver's side getting pinned, literally, and you have Josh Berry on top of him airborne, and both of those drivers walked away with no scars, bruises, anything.
Yeah, well, honestly, it was the impact, right? It was the impact that that created that problem. And look, I think what it was is how the car got hit when it was hitting the wall. We've seen that with the Dale Earnhardt wreck, that, you know, being that if there's people in other areas adding to the force that's happening in the car, it can create, you know, a very bad situation. And I feel like that's, you know, what we've seen with Eric Jones. It is a terrible situation, and we don't want to see any of the drivers ever get hurt. You know, it's the hope that NASCAR will once again evaluate why. They will look at the amount of G-forces that was created when he hit the wall, and once again try to add something else to this race car to make it fold a little bit better. Because honestly, you didn't think that the hit was that bad until you seen the breather or whatever that was, the silver component that was on that race car completely torn off. And then you're realizing, wow, I've not ever seen that happen before. So that obviously is the lead tell that something, that hit was harder than what it actually looked like. You know, it didn't look like that bad of a hit. But the aftermath of it was definitely, complete destruction of the race car. If the motor moved and was able to pop the breather out, then, you know, it's no telling the amount of G-forces that was actually incurred when he hit the wall, because those motors are steel blocks, Chaz Taylor. They're not supposed to give.
Right. And, I mean, hey, they've taken more impact than they have before. I mean, if you remember the Chris Buescher flip that happened, what was it, the first year we had the next-gen car? I think if the front end didn't break, that car looked like if you could have taken a few hammers, try to dent out or straighten out some of the dents, get some of the sheet metal away from the tires and whatnot, I think that car probably could have ran. Now we could have put, now the cars will take more of an impact, so the driver doesn't get dealt with that. Obviously, to an extent, as you had mentioned, the car will take the impact to an extent to where the driver's going to feel some of it. And as you mentioned, you know, Dale Earnhardt took an impact. The car took quite the impact. It took a lot of the damage. But Earnhardt did too. And unfortunately, it costed the life of Dale Earnhardt. But Eric Jones, unfortunately, you know, took some of the impact. But the car took a lot of the impact that it could.
Right.
And the good part about this is that NASCAR took Jones' car back to the R&D center for research and looking to see how it took the impact. Obviously, NASCAR is always, they always talk about how to increase safety. Is there something that could be implemented, you know, to kind of either limit or take away any injuries? And we all know that regardless of what, if you play a regular ball stick sport or when you're in a motor sport or even in like extreme sports like snowboarding, skateboarding, athletes take injuries. Not everything is always in your control.
Right. Yeah, I mean, people are going to get hurt. It's a sport. That's part of sports. People's careers are ended early, as we've seen with Kurt Busch. But we don't want to lose our drivers to injuries. I just watched a video not too long ago. I think it was by Iceberg or somebody, about the life of Eric McClure. And how basically after his wreck, things spiraled out of control. He wound up with a blood disease because of extensive bruising and stuff that he suffered while in the NASCAR series. I think it was in the Xfinity series that he raced mainly in. It led to an early death for Eric McClure. Of course, we see Jerry Nadeau. We know Dick Triple committed suicide because he couldn't live in the pain that he was in anymore. Then you have other guys like Richard Petty, who obviously had a lot of thrills and spills in his career and speaks nothing of it these days. Just says, "Hey, look, you know, we just moved on." Like, you know, they even lost the grand, you know, he lost a grandchild, and it's, you know, it's just part of, he sacrificed a grandson to the sport, and is still just as involved as ever, right? It's going to be interesting to see if Kyle Petty's new son, you know, the newest son, the youngest son, if he doesn't somehow wind up, you know, another generational driver. I think 10 years ago when he was born, I don't think anybody really thought much of, you know, what the possibility was. But my ears certainly perked up when I found out that, you know, Kyle Petty had another son. You know, it's going to be interesting to see if he's, you know, going to lead or go the path of. It's probably going to be a lot harder for the newest child to get into NASCAR, considering, you know, Richard Petty's really just a public figure now. He doesn't really have any assets in the or stakes in the ball game. You know, and whether or not, you know, Kyle's not racing anymore, so it's really not, you know, a weekend thing, I don't think. But I guess he's involved with the broadcasting and stuff. So we'll see. You know, those are, you know, things that could possibly come up in the near future. But, you know, as I said, we don't want to lose any drivers at an early age. We don't want to put any guys in an early retirement. Injuries do happen. This is, I think, you know, Denny Hamlin broke his back. Eric Almirola broke his back. There's been several other drivers. Oh, Alex Bowman.
Yeah, Bowman with a sprint car injury.
Yeah, this is all kind of in the same ballpark, the same type of injuries. So, you know, long term, Eric Almirola was fine. I believe long-term, Denny Hamlin has been okay. You know, you expect the same thing from Eric Jones. But if we can make this car safer, we can – let's just throw this car away. Let's go ahead and get the Gen 8 out. Let's go – you know, let's not waste any time. Let's start designing the Gen 8, right? Let's get the car back to more of what it used to be and away from this, you know – a trial period where all I believe Jim France has done is say copy paste from my IMSA series, from the numbers on the side of the car to the type of car that they're racing. So I know people will agree or disagree. I would much rather have Brian France back right about now than I do having Jim France at the top. And look, Jim was great for a few years. And he helped stabilize NASCAR when it was really falling out of control, right? Because people were jumping off the ship pretty quickly. He brought in some things that have been really good, and you know, he giveth and taketh away, obviously, with these charters. To think that somebody paid $40 million for a charter last year, and they may not even be relevant next year. That's crazy, and it's asinine. So you don't create a system and then just take it away. I do understand where NASCAR doesn't want to basically promise these a lifetime acceptance to these charters because they want the ability to take it away from people who are abusing the system. I'm just not sure if there's a fine line between the two. The reason why NASCAR does not want to give out a lifetime charter or a medallion to one of these cut teams is because they know that once that happens, we're going to basically bring back the starting parks in the Cup Series for the backmarker teams, Tad Taylor, because they're not going to they wouldn't have to compete like they do now if they're guaranteed that charter for a lifetime. So you're not going to see these guys making any improvements on their race team. You're just going to see them trying to make it week to week because they're guaranteed a pretty large paycheck. And we all know how business works. They're going to make the profits before anything because that's what businesses do. And so, you know, I understand where NASCAR is coming from, but at the same time, you know, this is the only sport that's a national sport, a worldwide sport, that's not controlled by some type of union. And we're from Mississippi. We're not big on unions here. But let me tell you something. There needs to be somebody protecting both sides and somebody representing both sides. And until that union is created, these drivers and teams are at the helms of whatever Jim France wants to do. And if he wants to get rid of the charter system, whether it's a lethal mistake or it's the right thing, I don't see how it could be the right thing when you have companies that have borrowed money to pay, for one of these charters, only to a few years later not have those charters anymore and that guarantee to the prize money or purse money that was originally decided in the agreement. So what's your thoughts on that?
I think get rid of charters in general. I think
what?
I feel like charters, I don't know. I just feel like charters in general just in my personal opinion just need to go. Because say we get back to 40 plus car fields and let's say a chartered team car, for instance, like say if a, I'm just going to throw one out here for example, say if a, I don't think it's likely, but anything's possible. Say if a Penske car, say if there are 42 cars entered, only 40 make the show. Say if a Penske car does not qualify for a race, then they should sit out. That's my opinion. I mean, look at the ARCA deal that happened at Daytona. Van Gisbergen did not qualify for the ARCA Daytona race. But when they threw out a chunk of change, a driver that had an opportunity to make a name for himself with little to no money on that race team took the money and ran instead of trying to make a name for himself. Try to get a finish. Bring some more money in for your race team.
Good for that baby.
Well done.
And I feel like when you take a open team, when you have charters, so you have 36 guaranteed cars and you have 6 open teams. 2 open teams are basically looking at them. There's all these 6 open teams look at themselves in the mirror like, well, there's a good chance we won't make the show, so we just did all this work for pretty much nothing. It kind of hurts that lower funded team, I believe.
Right. Well, you know, look, the top 35 worked forever. The cutoff was after 5 races. They had a championship provisional. I think the biggest fear back in the 2000s was that their poster boy, Jeff Gordon, might miss a race or something like that. But the top 35 rule, I think, was around from the like middle 90s or whatever all the way to this until the new system was implemented, I think, in 2016. Basically, after 5 races of the season, the top 35 would be locked in. And if NASCAR wanted to, I don't know how you can take away something that somebody just paid $40 million for, and then the next day you say, well, that it doesn't exist anymore. I think that NASCAR would, I think that's a play on some banks or something. I don't know. It sounds like fraud to me, to be honest with you. Somebody pay for something that's nothing more than a sheet of paper and then say that sheet of paper is worthless, then as a bank, I'm asking myself, well, why the hell would I even loan you any money in the first place when there's no specific guarantee that that this is actually even a legit business, right? Because the whole idea is to give these teams something that that gives them a significant value, because if not, then all they are is a bunch of car parts and motors and chassis.
I mean, Xfinity series and truck series don't have charters, and they do just fine.
Yeah, they get a very small piece of the pie.
But they still don't do it, and they do just fine.
Right.
I think Cup Series should follow that same example. Maybe more open teams can come in and try to give themselves a shot. Like, we could possibly see more of Beard Motorsports, for example, try to give their hand into a few more races. I'm just going for a shot in the dark here, but we can go for a long shot of Levine family returning for two races of their choosing, and shoot, they could pull a miracle and outrun, say, a front row or an RFK car, for example, or maybe a 2311 car. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, and you could probably bring Dale Jr. into the Cup Series tomorrow if you just get rid of the charter system. So that may be what NASCAR's actually looking at.
I mean, there's that possibility too. Dale Jr. has been wanting to get in, but he doesn't have the money to put in for a charter. Or maybe he does, and he's just not willing to fork it up. Or maybe he thinks the charter is too much.
Maybe his bank advisor tells him that it's a bad investment until there's a legitimate threshold on how long these charters are good for, If they're only good for 7 years and then they have to be renewed, well, then that should be the cap on how much you should have to pay for one, right? Because in 7 years, there's a certain amount of revenue that charter is going to generate, in percentage-wise. And so that should be the value of that said charter, right? If you're going to generate $2.5 million a year off of, that's a low number there, I guess. So let's just say $20 million a year off of what you can generate revenue from said charter, then if they're going to only do it in 7-year increments, then you would take 10% of that, I guess, and have
But the other thing you have to look at,
a $14 million charter, right? So,
here's one piece of the charter system where we haven't talked about, and I know we talked about it late in the season last year, is that you can have a charter agreement for 7 years. So say if Dale Jr. gets that charter and goes for 7 years, there is a little catch in this 7-year deal. You have to make sure you finish high enough in the owner standings. If you are the worst chartered team, or you're in the bottom three chartered team for like 3 years in a row or something like that, you have to give up your charter.
Take it away. Right.
And
Which is the reason why they don't want to guarantee a charter system to these race teams, because
and
they
with,
will be taken advantage of.
And look at the BJ McLeod team. He had a charter and finished low, very low, in his 2-3 years as a Cup Series owner. This year, he's not a charter. He's only running a handful of races in Cup, and it hurt his team so much in that sense that he's had to knock down his Xfinity team schedule down to a part-time.
Right. Yep. So, you know, and he's a $40 million man. So, you know, he made out like a bandit for his race team, especially if that's the last one ever sold, right? As I said, if they're going to only be in agreement for 7 years and they have to renew, then the bank loan should only go for what can be paid off in seven years instead of these astronomical numbers that have already been created out of the charter system, because that's a supply and demand issue. If these charters are only guaranteed for 7 years and then they have to requalify for them, then those loans being used to buy these charters will become significantly lower, because you're only basing it off of, like I said, what you could make out of 7 years from the revenue. And you have signed your 10-year deals with the TV revenue, so that would all make everything in place so that you would know the exact amount, you know, percentage-wise of where you would stand, you know, with paying for one of these charters. Right now, you know, $100 million could be the next charter, right? Or $200 million. And there's no significant evidence that you'll ever make that money back in NASCAR, especially when you've got the biggest team in NASCAR, Hendrick Motorsports, that says they haven't made a profit in 10 years. So how are you going to go out and spend $200 million on a charter system only to earn $20 million a year off the TV revenue package? You know, I mean, that would take 20 years to pay for that. So we're definitely at the threshold where some good accountings are going to have to get this shit figured out and figure out whether or not we need to put a cap on how much these charters are, whether or not they're going to be a limited supply or a lease type deal where for 7 years, and you know, in a lease deal, you have the option of buying out or giving it back. And I think that's something that could very well be something that these race teams look into, a lease charter option, right? You lease it, you say, okay, well, you know, I'm going to get this much out of it. And at the end of the 7 years, they have the choice to give it back to NASCAR or pay, you know, to hold the lease agreement once again. You know, I think that those are all because if revenue is going to be created off of a piece of paper, I at least want it to be a legit piece of paper and not something that somebody else can say 5 years down the road, oh, well, those don't even exist anymore, correct? I mean, it really does come down to numbers and making sense and accountings, right? Accountings and lawyers. Those are the guys that have got to get this shit figured out. Because, as I said, there's no way that anybody's going to pay $40 million right now for a charter and not even know if they're going to be used next year, right? And so, and then we don't want anybody paying $200 million for a charter and never being able to recoup those types of funds based off of the current TV deal. Any thoughts on that suggestion there, Taz, before we get to Taz's hot picks? You wanted to say something about IROC. So rumors are that IROC racing is coming back.
Oh, yeah. It was announced. It's officially, actually. The weekend of July 19th, I believe it is. The weekend of July 19th, 20th, 21st, that weekend. I forget the 2 days they said they were going to do this. IROC returns to Lime Rock Raceway Park. First IROC event since 2006, I do believe. I don't know if they're going to do one race, do like a practice day and then a race day, or if they're going to do two races. We have not heard anything on drivers yet, but I will say this. Do not expect current Cup stars or current IndyCar stars. You're probably going to see more of the either the part-time drivers, or you'll probably see more of the older/retired drivers take part in this.
So because again, we're going to see Michael Waltrip and Paul Tracy and Bill Elliott and all these people that you know, or yesterday's has-beens, and we're supposed to be excited about that.
Well, I think this is where they missed the mark. Isn't there?
Uh huh.
Well, isn't there like doesn't NASCAR take a break for like the Olympics this year?
Yeah. Yeah, 2 weeks. It's going to be really miserable for most of us.
I feel like IROC kind of missed the mark there.
Yeah, for sure. They should have been scheduled for that week. All right. Well, we'll keep our eye on that and a little bit more. Let's get into Taz's hot picks before we send it off tonight.
All right, so we head to the concrete monster mile known as Dover. And with those hot picks comes with the favorites of Kyle Larson, Chase Elliott, Martin Truex Jr. The contenders I have listed as Kyle Busch, Joey Logano, Denny Hamlin. Underdogs, I got the amigo, Daniel Suarez, Ricky Stenhouse Jr., and Chris Buescher. I know there's a couple big names that are not on the table, and I'm sure Chris will easily mention them in, like, 2 seconds.
Well, I'm looking over here at the Vegas odds. Of course, Larson is number one on odds. Truex is number two. I'm just wondering, did you read this one straight off the Hamlin's number three? William Byron, Ross Chastain, Christopher Bell, Chase Elliott, Ryan Blaney. Let's start with those.
All right, so Larson and Elliott, I have listed as Larson and Elliott. I do want to make note. Larson and Elliott, I put as favorites for good reason. They are the only two drivers currently of current Cup stars who have not only have an average start within the top 10, but also have an average finish within the top 10.
There's something even, like, right down here. There's something even right down here.
William Byron's not on the list, and that's, that guy's just, he's probably going to win 12 races this year. I'm not lying. Should be a favorite. William Byron, I think, is the strongest Hendrick driver right now in the Hendrick camp.
All right.
There's without a doubt that he should be at least a contender, probably a favorite.
All right, we throw him in the favorite. Ryan Blaney only has three top 10, so that's going to be a contender. He has one top five at this track. This is not one of his strongest ones, so I wouldn't expect Blaney to be a big guy this weekend. Brad Keselowski needs to get noted.
Well, what has he done at Dover? First of all, is concrete his cup of tea?
Ryan Blaney?
No, Brad Keselowski.
At Dover, Brad has one win, five top fives, 11 top tens. He has the fourth best average finish of current Cup drivers, and that ranks above William Byron.
Wow. He's coming off of 2 second place finishes, Taz Taylor.
Talladega, Texas.
I'm not sure where did Keselowski finish there last year?
Oh, boy. Last year's race. Perfect. Brad Keselowski finished eighth last year and finished
in the top 10 in stage one, missed out on stage two.
Oh. All right, well, let's throw Brad on the – let's throw him on the underdog list.
Underdog?
Yeah, let's give him the underdog.
I like the contender better. I feel like that's more suitable.
But you've got a former Cup champion not on this list. You've got Christopher Bell that's not on this list. And
Bell's not that hot at
all. Whether or not you want to see this or not, Ty Gibbs is, you know, he's trending on the upward end, and Ford's not. Ford has yet to even win a race this year. You know, as a fan of Brad Keselowski, it takes a lot for me to have to say to put him on the underdog list, but I almost feel guilty of even putting him here.
I think he's got a good argument for contender. I'm not putting him an underdog because Christopher Bell, Dover's not his cup of tea, to be honest with you. I mean, Reddick is not even – Reddick and Dover don't mix very well either.
I kind of expect the Fords to be good here. Erica Marola – I think last year had a really good run at Dover in the Stuart Haas racing. This is a short track, so you would expect your short track guys to come out. You should have a good outing by Josh Berry. We should get to see a little bit of his talent in the mix here.
All right.
Daniel
Suarez. He sounds like a legit underdog.
Yeah, okay.
Trying to think underdog wise would be a good one.
Well, what does he look like? He's a plus 700, which is actually in the same as William Byron, Denny Hamlin, and Martin Truex, all a plus 700. Ross Chastain is getting a lot of favor from Vegas right now.
Well, Ross Chastain was the runner up last year. It finished in both stages in top tens, including a stage two win. Maybe there is a favorite knocking in there, sleeping through.
It could be.
All right, we'll put Ross's aggression tour on the favorite category. And
oh,
I'm putting Big Brad. I'm putting Big Brad on the contender. I can't leave him off for having.
Damn, Allmendinger is in this race.
I don't know, but he would be a good underdog. I'm going to find an entry.
Let's stick to Ty Gibbs.
Oh, AJ Allmendinger is in this race.
I'm not sure how many first-time winners have ever come out of Dover.
Well, Ty Gibbs has yet to score a top 10, but he's only ran Dover once. Although it was a 13th place finish. I'll give him the underdog. I'll give him benefit of the doubt. Wow, that makes our list already there.
Oh, yeah?
Our list is full.
All right. That sounds good.
So we have
and Jimmy
Larson.
Johnson's in this race.
What's that?
Jimmy Johnson's in this race.
Dover doesn't. Not happening.
It's crazy. Crazy. Will we finally see Jimmy Johnson piece together a decent finish?
I think he completed all the laps at Texas a couple weeks ago. So, I mean, I feel like that's kind of a, from where he has been, that's an improvement.
That's a plus, huh? Considering who we're talking about here, no doubt, no doubt.
Small
you know,
victory.
We're making a big deal about Jimmy Johnson, and we got to go here because it's 9 o'clock. But we make a big deal about Jimmy Johnson as if we forgot that Richard Petty rode around for 10 years uncompetitive. That Bill Elliott showed up for 6 to 7 years, well after he was done and finished with, probably 10 years even better. Terry Labonte, you know, I think after 03, he was irrelevant, but he didn't retire until, like, 2016. So, you know, most of the time these drivers just don't sell off in the sunset with their victories and, you know, start drawing a retirement check. You know, they stick around past where they should. I think that expectations for Jimmy, we should have true enough expectations and want to just see him be able to contribute to the growth of Legacy Motor Club and not get out there and wreck race cars and overextend resources. I think that a win-win for Jimmy right now is a good top 20 finish and completing all the laps. And anything better than that would be, you know, a gift. It would definitely be a surprise because of how things have been going. But I want to see that. I want to see that from one of the, I believe, during his time, I hated him as a driver. I've always been against the driver who wins all the time. But when you look back on his career, I respect the hell out of Jimmy Johnson, just as I do Tom Brady. I hated Tom Brady. But to the end of his career, he proved to me that he was worthy of my fanhood, right? And I think that that's where I stand with Jimmy Johnson. I want him to be successful at some point in time in this endeavor that he started. Because if you look at the success of Denny Hamlin, you look at the success of Tony Stewart with Stewart Haas, you look at the success already of Brad Kay over at Roush Fenway, you don't want Jimmy Johnson to be that one that didn't work. That's just, you know, I think that you and I can both agree with that. You were a long-time fan. I was a long-time hater. I think we both agree that we don't want to see him be the guy that fails at this, right?
Yeah, I would like to see him. I think eventually he'll be a successful owner if he plays his cards right.
Yeah. All right, race fans, well, we pieced it together. We got through it. We want to thank you guys for listening to the show. We'll be back next week. Taz Taylor, how about sending us out, man?
All right, we want to thank everyone for listening to Race Chat Live tonight. Thank you, Blog Talk Radio, for working with us. If you ever miss a show live...
Hey, here's to that.
If you ever miss a show live, check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spreaker, Spotify, you name it, we're on it. And, of course, YouTube as well. Facebook is where we also do a lot of our postings. So you can find us on Facebook. And without further ado, this has been the Caution Flag Racing Radio, Chris Crane. I'm the Tasmanian Double Flaggers, Taz Taylor. And good night. We'll see y'all next Tuesday. Blog Talk Radio, please work with us.
Yeah, please. Thank you for listening, guys. Have a great night.